I can't see it from here.
You don't have it in the background. We have ours in the background just so to make it, it makes us feel important. So yeah. But that's a good tip.
I would feel so inadequate compared to your guys because I started doing the Kindle thing a few years back and my print collection hasn't grown like it used to. I think the title is One Bird at a Time and I can't remember the author's name, but it's for,
it's not Drayden Bird, is it?
No. It's, she writes stuff for, you know, regular writers, not copywriters, but
okay. Yeah.
One of the big takeaways I got from that book was like the only thing standing between you and in like in our case as copywriters, only thing standing between you and having really great copy is you being willing to produce a really shitty first draft, you know, and everybody thinks, so I'm just going to bang out something, you know, and throw it out there and I'm going to make millions. It's like, nah, you know, it's like, it's banging it out and writing a headline that just completely sucks so bad it stinks up the place, you know. And it's like the process to get to the good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Is it bird by bird or one bird at a time?
I think it's bird by word.
Bird by bird, Anne Lamont.
Anne Lamont. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's a classic there. 1995 bestseller. I may have to pick that one up. I've seen that one before because it's every once in a while it comes up on some of the books. I think a good tip for copywriters too, or anybody that wants to persuade, like don't just read marketing and copy books. Go find books from writers.
Yep.
I mean, it is different, but there's something they know about captivating people with words that does, I think, matter and make your writing stronger. You can get caught up in like, you know, getting too wordy and too flowery. But if you're reading the right writers, Stephen King, Patterson, James Patterson, you know, those guys, there's some good tips in there.
I agree. Have you guys ever read any of Stephen Pressfield's stuff, either his fiction or his nonfiction stuff?
Yeah. I've read most of his nonfiction. I've never read his fiction.
His guy blows me away.
What is it? What is it? The War of Art?
Yeah.
Is that one?
The War of Art.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great book.
It's so true.
His style, man. Anytime I start to think, I think I write more editorial stuff these days than copy. I'm still writing copy, but, anytime I start thinking, I'm getting pretty good at this editorial stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I'm so quickly humbled when I read any of his stuff, like either fiction or nonfiction. He publishes a blog and he puts out a new post every Wednesday. And it's usually very short, like in a couple hundred words, what he says in a couple hundred words is amazing. He's a great study, I think, for any kind of writers, but for copywriters, I think should be looking at that stuff too.
What was the, what's the book series that was it Howard used to recommend, the detective series?
Oh yeah. The Travis McGee series. Travis McGee is the character's name. You're going to have to Google it to correct me on the author's name. I'll see if I can see into the
McDonald.
Yeah. 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 That's it. John McDonald. That's some really well-written stuff.
And that was like early on in the whole detective series, mystery stuff. But yeah, for those listening that wanted to do something besides read nonfiction, but still get that flow of writing and the quick writing, you know, that doesn't get bogged down in description, but tells you everything you need to know about the scene. You know, that's what's cool about those books. And James Patterson, I think, you know, James Patterson was a copywriter.
Yep.
Before he started writing fiction books.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. He was for, I can't remember which agency he was with, but yeah, one of the big ones.
Does he even write anymore though? But
yeah, there's a fascinating video if you can find it. He was on CBS Sunday Morning, I don't know, probably 6 or 7 years ago now, where he went through his process of how he does like his cub writers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And he'll do like a 25 page outline by hand in pencil. He sends it off, you know, FedEx or something. They fill it in. They they draw out the story. He gets it back. He's edited it. And he'll have like 10 to 25 books going at a time between his different writers and just managing it all, writing it all. And every one of his writers become their own.
Sure.
You know, big writers. Absolutely. It's fascinating. I forget sometimes to read more fiction like that to keep that kind of that. I think the life, the verbs, the adjectives are so much better in fiction than what we use a lot of times in copy, and we get lazy in copy.
Okay. So what's that series, John? What's that detective series?
I think it's John McDonald.
Yeah, John
McDonald. Travis McGee.
Travis McGee.
Okay.
And all the, well, I'm not sure that all the titles, but a lot of the titles always have a color in them.
Right.
The blue something, the green something.
Yeah, it's like The Deep Blue Goodbye, Nightmare in Pink, A Purple Place for Dying. That even makes sense.
It's pretty addictive stuff, though. I mean, if you just, you know, crack one open, mm-hmm. you know, I dare you to stop reading.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely beach fiction type stuff. You got
my attention. I want to read. I want to check that out. Because I love reading. I like reading good fiction. I mean, I'm not, you know, a lot of people don't like Stephen King, but I actually like his, or they don't like his politics, but I actually like reading. I mean, he's really, because, you know, his book on writing for anybody that wants to do even copy, sales copy is, you know, Sean and I have mentioned that book a number of times, is that's like a great starter for anybody that's looking to write. You know, it's simple writing, how to write simply.
Yeah. But, I tell you, I don't know if I ever told you this, Dan, but when I went to work at Agora for Stansberry, Mike Palmer was my copy chief, and that was the first thing he had me do was read On Writing by Stephen King.
Yep. Oh, no kidding.
Before I was allowed to write anything, I had to sit at my desk and read that whole book.
Now you guys are motivating me to reread that. I've only read it once. I've got it on my Kindle, but I'm going to go reread that again.
Yeah. It's a good reminder too of like the grind of writing in mm-hmm. general. Cause you know, he talks about in the first half of the book is kind of his life story and how he became a writer and all this stuff. And the second half is kind of the actual act of writing and discipline of writing. And, it reminds you, oh yeah, this is hard work. Like I know that, but it's good to know that I'm not the only one who thinks this is hard work.
He writes every day, regardless.
Absolutely.
No exception.
And he reads even more.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what makes him a great writer. I mean, he's always reading stuff. So
that's another thing. I know I felt a lot of guilt when I first started, because I'd always done either, you know, hard labor or sales where I was in an appointment doing, you know, selling at the kitchen table, you know, so I was in the act of doing. So when I got, you know, to writing copy, especially at Agora, like you have to do a lot of research to write what they write. And you'll spend as much time reading as you will writing. Mm-hmm. And at first that felt really weird to me. Like I could not wrap my head around that I was getting paid to read, because I always thought reading was a leisure activity.
Sure.
And I think that's just how that's kind of the world I grew up in, is like reading something you do when you're not working. So I had to get my head around that. And I see that today with a lot of writers that I talk to, is they don't spend enough time reading anything. I mean, these books we're talking about, research, whatever it is. There's a quote, Jonathan, in that book that says, if you don't have time to read, you don't have time to write.
Nope.
Which is pretty strong words from one of the best-selling writers of all time. So.
It makes sense. I mean, you can't create something from nothing. Actually, I mean, writers don't really create anything. I would say more so that they synthesize. Mm-hmm. But the only way you can synthesize is you got to have the materials to synthesize from. So you take in all this stuff, and then this one piece from this source, you know, gets combined with this other piece from this other source, and you synthesize something new.
Sure.
So if you're staring at a blank page and you put no input in,
you got a really
hard job. Yeah. Probably a damn near impossible job.
Yeah. But if you can start piecing together and have a research doc and you're dropping quotes in, and you know, and I remember one time I was writing a piece of copy and Mike Palmer came up to me and he's like, this is really good, but I think you should go, this guy, I mean, have you ever met Mike?
No, I've always wanted to, just never had the opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, the amount of reading he did is just amazing, and he was like, go to the library, check out this book, turn to the like certain chapter or appendix or something. Maybe it was the introduction, read the intro, set the book down, and then rewrite that intro in your own voice and use that as your intro. Mm. I was like, okay. Wow. So I went, got it. And sure enough, like that intro was like just perfect for what we were trying to say. So I read it, set it aside, and just in my own words, in the voice of the, you know, of the writer of the letter, just put it out. And, you know, sure enough, it was a pretty good letter. It worked out pretty good.
Wow.
So knowing, but that doesn't happen if you're not reading a lot of stuff so that you can say, oh yeah, I remember that passage. I could rephrase that or quote that or whatever and pull that in here and pull this in here. And that cumulative knowledge over time, I think, is what makes writers better and better and better.
Mm-hmm. For sure. I agree.
So I've got a question. I'm going to steer us back to Dan's book, Sail the Damn Thing. So you've got a chapter, and I want you to give kind of an overview, because you've got the JSTDT, which you've trademarked. That's for people that are kind of slow there. That's just
the interest of full disclosure. So I did apply for the trademark. And it was rejected.
What?
And then the attorney said, you know, no problem. We can get this approved. Just give us money.
Put TM by the name, and you don't need the lawyers, right?
It was the old school trademark. Sure. Just like, you know, like the, what's the word I'm looking for? When people put the copyright notice on their stuff, yep. You know?
Absolutely. If I can't get a trademark, I just put TM beside it. You know,
yeah.
It's what option two on the Mac, I think it is.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I learned a long time ago that the only thing an attorney can tell you is give me money. Their answer to everything is give me money. So I'm sure they can push this through, you know, get this finalized. Just, it'll take 2 years and, you know, probably like $500,000.
So. All right. So it's not technically or officially trademarked, but give us the overview of the secret sauce of the just sell the damn thing sales copy.
Oh, geez. Now you're asking me to go from memory. All right. So
that's chapter seven, by the way. Okay.
One of the secret sauces is the eyeballs looking at the offer.
Right.
Right. It's like probably the most important thing. Sure. You can, you know, the right eyeballs. You can have the best model, the best funnel, the best copy. If the eyeballs are off, then, you know, if you're lucky, if it works at all. So, like, you know, I've made some pretty good money with pretty half-assed copy. Like back when I had my supplement business and mm-hmm. back was against the wall and bills came in unexpected, I needed money, you know, like you just got to crank out something fast and just sure. sell the damn thing. And as long as it's in front of the right eyeballs, you know, you'll probably do okay.
Yeah.
You know, the ideal is the right eyeballs plus the right funnel, the right model and the right copy.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, you can sell anything if you, getting right from the right. I mean, that's kind of the old Gary Halbert stuff, right? Yep. Am I breaking up?
No,
you're good. Okay.
I was getting a little feedback. So, yeah, that was like the old starving crowd, right? Give me any advantage, I'll take the starving crowd. So kind of the same idea, traffic. You know what's crazy? Just yesterday, I was thinking about, I read the word traffic and I was reading something else about retailers. And I was like, oh, that's why they call it traffic online, because that's how they used to measure retail traffic, was by the number of cars that drove by. For some reason, that never actually clicked with me until yesterday. It's like, have you ever seen those internet memes where it's like, when's the first time you realized whatever about certain product?
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, what else you got there, Jonathan? Then we're going to let Dan go and
so,
let
him. Yeah. Pitch I was going to say in that chapter, you reference one. Sean and I have talked about this is one of the biggest, probably one of the biggest promos. And this was like in the last Great Recession, the end of America. You remember that. So what are some aspects from that campaign? Cause you talk about that in the chapter. That was hugely popular, to use a Donald Trumpism. Huge. So, I mean, what made that promotion so popular during that time?
It's fantastic.
So that was Stansberry. Were you working with them back then, Sean?
So interesting backstory on that is, that idea was actually Porter's idea, and it had been floating around the copywriting pool. There was 12 or 13 writers there for about 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. And nobody could quite get it right. And then in 2010, I took a couple stabs at it. Didn't get it, obviously. And then I actually moved on and went freelance after I'd been there for about a year and a half. And it was right after I left that Mike kind of came out with the final draft of End of America. And he even tried it a couple of times and it didn't. He tried different angles and it didn't work. So, you know, it goes back to what we were saying earlier. Like, this is not easy to pull off. Like, this was not, I think one thing that made that work was timing as much as anything. Yeah. Mike Palmer had an incredible sense for timing. And knowing what the market kind of was feeling and wanting to hear and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, that was a promo that bounced around and went through 5, 6, 7 different copywriters and leads and attempts before it actually came out in that form with that story and all that.
That was a pretty attention grabbing big idea. You know, talking about the right eyeballs, you get in front of the right eyeballs with the right big idea at the right time. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how those home runs happen.
Absolutely.
You know, just you hit on something that just resonates so strongly with the market. And if you can get the timing right, like, you know, COVID is still top of mind.
Sure.
Yep.
Right now, you know, the right big idea, you know, that's another way that you can make a lot of money, even with somewhat half-assed copy. If you nail the big idea, mm-hmm. like, and the rest of your copy wouldn't be considered world-class, but you got in front of the right eyeballs with the right big idea, then as long as you do the basics right, you know, like, click here to order. Here's what to do next. Click here to order that. You know, if the big idea is right on, you don't necessarily need world-class copy. I'm not saying that the End of America wasn't world-class copy. That was definitely A-list copy. But, mm-hmm. I mean, it took them a while, but they totally nailed that big idea. That's for sure.
So how would you define big idea? And I know this is a conversation. When you start getting that level of copy, it takes on a life of its own almost. But how would you explain a big idea to somebody?
It's the theme that everything else hangs on in the piece. And it's like, if you're saying, well, what's this about? And then you say,
yep,
it's about this. And that's, you know, that's the big idea. You know, it's about this, the end of America. This country is, you know, it's an empire and it's amazing. It's lasted this long. It's going down, brother. Down in flames. And, you know, in front of the right people, you have their undivided attention.
Sure.
Especially the people who already believe that.
Yeah.
You know, we're always selling to we're always preaching to the choir. You know, we're not converting the unconverted. We're converting the converted, you know? So yep. I guess, you know, I don't know if that's a good way of explaining it. In my mind, it's the theme upon which the whole thing hangs, you know? And then it's like repeated endlessly throughout the promotion. In fact, that's the only thing you basically talk about. And right. You might say it in different ways, but it's basically the only thing you're talking about in that whole piece.
So why are those so hard to find? Like, or pull off? Like,
well, you know, I've done hardly any work in financial. You've done a lot of work in financial, but there's a space that really hard to come up with a big idea for a lot of reasons. First of all, that's a super mature market. I mean, they've seen it all, heard it all. I mean, as far as consumers, they're pretty darn savvy. And you know, big time competition there. So they got a lot of really smart guys coming out with a lot of offers and a lot of big ideas.
Well, and the challenge in that market is as much as anything is that you can spend 4 or 6 weeks working on a promotion and then the market sentiment shifts and your whole promotion's dead.
Right.
Especially back end offers that are more like trade sensitive or whatever sensitive. Like that's one thing I could not stand about that market was like, it evergreen is almost impossible to write in that market. Like you're probably not going to do it.
Unless you're talking about gold.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
That seems to be just like, you know, going up and up and up. But so.
That goes back to Dan's point. Right. There's gold bugs out there.
Sure.
Who it doesn't matter what you say, if you can find one statistic that says gold is going to move higher again,
yeah,
every one of those gold bugs is going to double down
sure.
and buy that because it's already their worldview and you're just confirming it. And Jonathan, you and I talk about that all the time. Like if you can confirm people's existing worldview, you have their attention. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think you need to convince people of something else. The fact is you need to agree with them and further their belief.
Yeah.
If you want their attention. Yep. Would you agree with that, Dan, or disagree?
For the longest time, I really thought that's what my job as a copywriter was supposed to do. So I was supposed to convert the unconverted. I was supposed to make them believe, you know?
Yeah.
And boy, that's a tough, if not, you know, impossible job.
Yeah.
And it's so much easier to just sell to the converted. I won't get this quote exactly right. And I don't know who it's from, but for those who believe, no proof is necessary. For those who don't, no amount of proof is enough.
Right.
And that reminds me. So a piece I wrote for one of the Agora health divisions was for a, as I call it, a swing supplement, dating myself back in the 90s, you know, for a male potency supplement. And when I turned it in, I told the copy chief, like, you know, I've got all the proof elements. I mean, here they are in the sidebar, the comments thing in Microsoft Word, but I tried to include those in the promo and it just seemed to screw up the flow. So I cite no proof elements whatsoever in this copy. And the guy's name is Paul Amos. Like he knows health better than anybody. He's been working in health for 2 decades, I think. And his reply somewhat shocked me. I guess I knew this subconsciously, but I'd not heard anybody state it up until that point. And he said, yeah, proof elements are not necessary because they want to believe.
Sure. What you're trying to do is confirm what they already, you know, buy into or believe.
So, yeah. I mean, I can see that they're not necessary, but at the same time, it gives the believers something to go tell their believer friends about. Mm-hmm. That's the way I look at it.
Decision they've already made.
Yeah. And it's like when they meet at Hardee's for coffee the next morning, they can be like, did you hear?
Yeah.
And they can quote that fact, that piece of logic, that piece of news, and they feel good, you know, because a lot of the best copy is also like entertainment for people.
Yeah.
You know, they want to be able to, like, if you can find that piece of trivia, that piece of something that they can tell their friends about proudly, man, that's like an earworm or, you know, it just gets in their brain and they can't let it go. you know, and it's hard to go share that piece of information if you've also not went ahead and bought the whatever, yeah. I think. So, yeah, I think we all try way too hard to convince and don't spend enough time selling to what people already believe.
Even like when I didn't know what I was doing, you know, I just knew as close to a sure bet as I could find was, you know, this is back pre-internet days. I had a copy of the SRDS book, this big phone book, thick thing, standard rate and data service. It was a catalog of all the, the mailing lists available that you could rent. And so at night I'd look through there and try to find these obscure little niches, you know, of people buying stuff, and you find something like, you know, raising emus for fun and profit. You know, these people bought a book on raising emus for fun and profit or something like that. And I knew, like, you know what? A surefire moneymaker is to rent that list. And guess what I'm going to sell them? A book on raising emus for fun and profit.
Yeah.
You know, like, no need to reinvent the wheel. I don't want to challenge. I just want to make money, you know? So even back in the day, like, I knew, like, sell to the believers and sell what they're already buying.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. You can get a long way with that. I mean, you can even still like grow your business. Like, cause you know, it's not a limited supply. Most people that are interested in a subject like emus have 26 books, you know, 3 CDs, like, you know, they've been to 4 conferences and, you know, like they're not going to buy just one thing from one person. They're buying everything they can find on the subject.
I do the same thing. I mean, guitars, I don't need any more guitar instructional stuff, but I still keep buying like an addiction, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we don't need any more marketing books. They all say the same basic thing,
sure.
You know, or any more books on writing or anything like you got enough. But the fact is, if you're passionate about it, you keep buying that stuff. It's like people who are passionate about music, keep buying music and concert tickets and all that stuff. So I think that's a great, like, idea is, like, you know, find that crowd that you enjoy talking about and talking to, sell them the stuff that they already like. It's actually it's kind of a form of entertainment and hobby for them to buy stuff in that niche and learn about it. And, you know, everybody's happy. You make money, they get information, they get fed. It's a good world. Pretty cool system. Well, man, we've gone an hour and 18 minutes, so time's kind of flown. But, Dan, how can people find out more about you? You've got basically 2 entry points into your world, so why don't you share both?
Okay, and they both point to the same place. So my website is at DobermanDan.com. And if people want to see that, I think they might find that interesting because it's quite blatant on the opt-in page that you will get nothing free. And so it directs you to the book sales page. And that's how, you know, everybody comes into my world. If anybody just wants to go directly to the book sales page, is it justsellthedamnthing.com.
Okay. Hey, so we did have a question come in from a listener real quick before you run off. Yeah. So in the personal finance industry, so this is not like Agora stuff. This is more like Dave Ramsey.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Financial freedom. Who do you think would be the converted people? Like who already believe that's the question. Who do you think would be the converted people?
That's a really good question. You know, I don't know that market real well, but obviously, you know, he's built a huge following,
right?
You know, that's always a good space to be in, because is there anything more emotional for people than money? I mean, other than maybe sex, but I would even rate money higher than that, you know?
I think especially in this time, you know, when there's much uncertainty in the economy.
It'd be interesting to study. Like, I've never really looked deeply into any of those guys or Kiyosaki or Dave Ramsey or anything. It'd be interesting to study their model and see like what age demographics they're appealing to. The first thing that popped in my mind was and I don't think it's true for either Kiyosaki or Ramsey, is like people in my age demographic. Mm-hmm. Because in the US, it's very common for somebody to hit their 50s, late 50s, early 60s, and be at almost prepared, zero preparation for retirement. Right. So like they're freaking out, mm-hmm. and they got debts and they want to, well, you know, I've done a piss poor job of managing my money for the past 5 decades, but now I need to get rid of my debt and save enough money to retire in 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be interesting to see if they're appealing to that crowd. But then I've also seen Kiyosaki has like, he's done special stuff, especially for millennials. Mm-hmm. So who would be the converted? What obviously would be people who realize that they need to figure out how to manage their finances and get out of debt, yeah. and start saving, which so that's a pretty broad target right there.
Right.
Yeah. So it's people who realize that working harder is not going to be enough.
Yeah.
Right. So if you think about like, what's the psychology going on here? One, they don't believe, they realize that just working harder is not enough. They're going to have to learn to save and get out of debt. So they realize that the system of just earn more is not going to work. So yeah. probably not salespeople, because salespeople have an innate belief that they'll just sell more.
They'll sell more and make more. Absolutely. Yeah. They'll overcome and you cover the cost. Exactly. Right. I can tell you.
Yeah.
Works every time.
Three. Yeah, we're all three like that, right? Because we're on sales.
And that's how we sell it to our spouses too, right? I mean,
yeah.
Don't worry about this, because that's already been accounted for once I sell this and pay for it.
Exactly. That's always the response. I'll sell my way out of this.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So that, you know, that group is like, okay, they have an innate belief in their ability to go sell stuff. Mm-hmm. So you can sell them anything that will help them sell more stuff.
Sure.
Facebook ads course, copy course, anything on psychology of selling, like right. any of that stuff. They're like, well, of course that would help me, because that's what I already believe. Right. So personal finance, I guess it's going to be, if I get more control and manage my money better, mm-hmm. it will do better.
Yeah. I think you're right. I'm just thinking out loud right now, which usually is probably not a good thing to do on a tape.
It's okay. That's what we do.
Especially after a pint of Perrier. I mean, there's no telling what right. to come out.
Perrier is taking effect. I'm thinking that the target market would also be probably the opposite of the target market for not personal finance products, but like financial products. The yeah. people who buy this little known company, as soon as they get their FDA approval, your $50 investment will turn into $50 billion in the next 37 days. Like those two mindsets, I don't see that being the same person.
Right.
I'm going to see like there's the gambler at this extreme.
Exactly.
Who is certainly not thinking yeah. long-term or managing their finances. So whatever this market is that buys my $50 investment will turn into $50 billion in the next 30 days. Right. Then your personal finance crowd is the polar opposite, I think. Exactly.
I know, I agree with that. And that's actually one reason I left the financial industry, the financial newsletter industry, was that I just had a hard time writing that personally, because the very people that buy that are the people that are most emotionally unstable when it comes to managing their money. Like they have a hard time not buying into the emotion of a story, of a trade, of whatever. And the fact is, once you buy into the story of a company, it makes it infinitely harder to sell when you need to sell.
Yeah.
Because you bought the story, you didn't buy the fundamentals of the stock. Right. So you buy the story, you tend to hold on to the story. And I just got tired of selling that. And I'm sure somebody could make the argument, you know, that of the people who do great with financial newsletters, I just think it's
yeah.
pretty rare.
I can see why you got out of that. I can relate to that. It's like, I mean, you know, the reality is, hey man, you know, like you're 58, all right, you're still looking for your $50 investment or whatever, your $500 investment to turn into your funding your retirement. you know, the past five decades, maybe you should have been saving 10%, you know, and maybe putting it in, you know, an index fund.
Yeah, index fund. Yeah.
You know, if you're really risk averse, treasuries or something, you know, like that's the reality, but it ain't sexy.
Yeah. No.
You know, you can't sell that. Sexy is like, yeah, you pissed away your whole life. You can never retire, dude, unless this little known company,
their
approval.
It's like,
you know, your $1,000 investment.
Put all those eggs right there.
Yeah.
So they're cashing out. All right.
Yeah. So Maria is, so yeah, people know they have a problem, I think is the right answer. She kind of followed up here.
You don't want to
educate and try to convince them that they have the problem in the first place. It's an easier sell to people who know they have the problem and they're looking for the solution.
Yeah, because I think of Dave Ramsey. People that call in, because I listen to Dave Ramsey's podcast sometimes, people that call into his show, they obviously know they have an issue. They have a problem. Typically, mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, from listening to that age demographic is usually in the 30s to 50 range. And, you know, there's all sorts of questions. And it's like, you know, it's typically how to get out of debt. And so, you know, obviously Dave Ramsey uses his system and it's worked well for a number of years, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but they're already sold on the idea of getting out of debt.
Right. Like, they know they have an issue.
Right. So now it's how do I do that? And exactly. That's what he teaches.
They're completely sold on the fact that they have totally screwed up and they need a better way to get out of debt. So
yeah, sell more.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's the answer. They should sell more, but
they should get a real job that allows them to control their income.
That's what I always think.
Salary job.
Humongous shovel. You know, get a humongous shovel. That's what you need.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, thanks for that question, Maria. We will wrap up now. We've kept Dan quite a while here, so.
All right, I got to ask before Dan goes out. I have to ask because. Doberman Dan. I mean, okay. So give us a little background on that name, if you can, unless it's a secret. How did you come up with Doberman Dan, or did somebody give you that name, or did you take on that name yourself? Because it's not only your. I mean, it's on the book. So I mean, it's a part of you. So how did you come up with that?
I was going to show you my dog. He's sleeping on the floor, so I won't disturb him.
Okay,
I'll tell you about him in a second. But I had this Doberman, and I used to, when I wrote articles for the bodybuilding market, and I had some stuff published in the magazines. I wrote this article about when my Doberman was a puppy. He was probably, you know, 50 pounds, maybe, still a puppy. And he was at the park and he got in a fight with this Rottweiler, you know, an adult Rottweiler that was probably 130 pounds. And the Rottweiler was, you know, had the size advantage, was big and bulky, but my Doberman was like super lean, just, you know, muscle, you know, and agility. And like, he just like was all over this Rottweiler. The Rottweiler couldn't even move fast enough.
That's right.
I have a Rottweiler like had to crawl and hide under this picnic table while his two owners are freaking out, you know, and I was freaking out initially because I thought this Rottweiler is just going to bite my Doberman puppy in half. And my Doberman cleaned his clock. So I wrote an article about that. And then and the transition was, and geez, I realized that I've become a Rottweiler, you know, too much pizza and beers. And, you know, I look like this big, bulky power lifter back then. And I need to lean down and be like my Doberman. And this is a joke, tongue in cheek. I signed it instead of my real name. I signed it Doberman Dan. And like that stuck in that market. Yeah. And I thought at first I thought, well, wouldn't have been the nom de plume I would have chosen. But it happened.
Yeah.
So I'm sticking with it. And it worked out because like I've always hated my last name. It's misspelled. It's not correct. It's French Canadian from Quebec. It's Galipo, which is a somewhat common last name up there.
Sure.
But the immigration people screwed it up on the paperwork. And so it's spelled Galipo, ending in poo, P-O-O. I was teased relentlessly as shit. I hate that name.
You got to go Doberman in that case for sure.
Yeah. I just like, okay, I should have chosen a better nom de plume, but I'm going with this. I don't ever have to use my last name again, which nobody can spell, pronounce, remember. And everybody remembers Doberman Dan. So that's absolutely the story of
that. Yeah, and it's alliterated. So
absolutely. Yeah. It has to work. Perfect.
And the real secret, this totally blows my street cred. So the Doberman passed away several years ago. He was 13 years old when he died. And
was it Donner?
Yeah, Donner the Doberman. Now I have this other dog who thinks he's a Doberman, but he's a Shih Tzu. But I can't, you know, we can't let that get out. My street cred will be totally ruined.
That's right. It's it's too late now. It's you broadcast it, so.
But that was the Colombiana's choice, right?
Yeah. Yeah, she's right. She's right over here in the kitchen. She forced me to get this dog, even though I was totally against it. And I said, I don't want another dog. And she eventually persuaded me. And I sure am glad. I thought my Doberman was faithful, but like, this guy even tops him. And he thinks he's a Doberman. By the way, when he was a puppy, where he was born, there was this female Doberman. So he's always grown up around Doberman, and he believes he's a Doberman this big, 12 pounds.
In this day and age, if you identify as a Doberman, you're a Doberman.
Good point.
All right. Because I always think of Magnum. You remember the old Magnum? What is it, Higgins? Mm-hmm. Didn't he have a couple of Dobermans?
Yeah. I think that's what first Magnum PI plus. What was the name of a movie? There was a movie in the 70s, and this kid had these two protection trained Dobermans.
Sure.
And like, he'd unleash them on people and they'd tear him up. And I thought, that's the coolest thing in the world. I want a dog like that one of these days.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's good stuff. Well, guys, thanks for hanging in there with us, listening, and all you that listen later. But so DobermanDan.com. And then justsellthedamnthing.com. I'll put both those in the comments so you can find them there. And that just going through those funnels, and then I would recommend subscribing to Dan's letter for at least a year, to the Knights, the Round Table, to the Camelot, for at least a year to really kind of see how he does that. And it's becoming a lost art as far as the print newsletter. There's not a lot of them left.
Mm-hmm. Anymore.
Yeah. And, so good stuff. I've got a whole file cabinet full of them. So really good stuff. So go check that out. And I'll let you wrap it up, Jonathan.
Dan, it's been a pleasure, man.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate the invite. I had a good time.
All right, guys. Well, thanks again for listening. As always, you can find us over at Persuasion by the Pint. Dan, if you'll hang on, we'll converse after the broadcast. But we really did enjoy having you on. It's been a pleasure. And as always, you can find Dan over at justsellthedamnthing.com and DobermanDan.com. We'll be posting those on our show links. As always, thanks for listening, Sean. It's fun, man. We'll see you next time.
See ya.
Thanks, guys.